tonight is we're speaking the past couple of days really about when it's appropriate to compel a get. When you have a husband who is refusing to divorce his wife in a halachic fashion, so under what circumstances can a get be compelled? So now we're going to transition to another point, which is very, very crucial for understanding the mechanics of how things operate today. Let's assume that for whatever reason, kfiya is not appropriate. Let's assume that the circumstances that we're talking about, kfiya cannot be employed, either because it's illegal, as we discussed a little bit yesterday, if that's the kind of kfiya we're talking about, or because the halacha does not clearly call for kfiya. I emphasize clearly, because we saw over the past few days that there are many circumstances that are tali b'machlokas, and one could, through certain halachic positions, apply the din of kfiya to most circumstances today, either because, let's say, two major ways to get to that conclusion is if you follow the position of the Rambam, who says that mois alai, if the wife feels she is repulsed by the husband, that that's already grounds to justify kfiya, and if you interpret that in a very broad way, that it could mean essentially whatever she doesn't like about him is good enough. Or if you follow a position that a few Gedolei Poskim can hold, but many do not hold, that the reality of a couple not living together justifies kfiya. So then, you know, for one opinion or the other, you could make a case that kfiya is justified in many of the cases that we hear about today. But let's assume, for the purposes of practicality, especially because both of those points are very disputed, that kfiya is not really called for. But we have a circumstance where you can't continue like this, where the husband and wife are not living together, they're not happy together, and neither is permitted to marry the other. So what possibilities do you have? And it's also a good segue point to mention that there's another position of the Rambam that we spent some time on, that the Rambam says the reason kfiya works when it is appropriate is because even though a get has to be given meratzon, but we assume that every Jew's ratzon is to follow the halacha, and therefore, even if he says he doesn't want to, deep down he does want to, we just have to make the point clearer to him, we have to get through the Eitz Hara. So therefore, ultimately, we can extract that free will. So that is contingent on the assumption that there's a mitzvah involved. Now, in the Shulchan Aruch, and often invoked in contemporary Batei Din and their Psakim, we find that that doesn't seem to be the working assumption, because you find two categories, that sometimes there is a psak of kfiya, as we've been talking about, and sometimes there is a psak of mitzvah legarish. So apparently you could have a situation where the Rabbanim could declare that it's a mitzvah for the husband to give a get, but it's below the threshold of kfiya. There is also sometimes a language of chiyuv legarish. How exactly that fits in is a little unclear. Chiyuv may also be in the same category as mitzvah. It may just be a technicality, whether one or the other, but they both seem to be a level below kfiya. Now, this is a little bit ambiguous language, and when dealing with the realities of contemporary Batei Din, so sometimes, in practice, we have to try to analyze what a psak means and read it very, very carefully. When a psak will come from a Beis Din and it'll use language like mitzvah lagarish, chayiv lagarish, etc., etc., is the Beis Din calling for kfiya? Is it not calling for kfiya? Is there an assumption of very precise language? The language mean to convey something below that? Often this is a practical issue that has to be clarified. But the whole notion of a distinction already illustrates that you could have a difference between the two, that you could have a mitzvah, and still it doesn't necessarily trigger all the terminology of kfiya. So if that's the case, so how do we deal with such circumstances? What do we do with a circumstance where there is a understood mitzvah lagarish, but we have neither the tools nor even the official go-ahead for kfiya? What's the possible option for us? So I'll mention at the outset, so for example, if you're asked to be involved in certain tools of social pressure, such as rallies and the like, so very often the premise is that that is not a vehicle of kfiyah, but that's something short of kfiyah. So the reason that's happening, there are those who may interpret it differently, but the reason it's happening is because the assumption is that even if kfiyah is not halachically called for, this is less than kfiyah. So what category is it? That's a fair question. But there is a category in between, which I'm opening a Shulchan Aruch here to read to you the language of the Shulchan Aruch. There is a category in between, which is known as Harchakos de Rabbeinu Tam. And that name is very important, because Rabbeinu Tam is the authority for the Harchakos. Harchakos meaning distances, right? The things that you do to create distancing between society and a person. And Rabbeinu Tam, his authority is very important. I'm opening up here the Shulchan Aruch, Kuf Evna Ezer, Kuf Nun Dalid, Siv Chaf Aleph. And there the Shulchan Aruch quotes Rabbeinu Tam, who happens to be quoted by many of the Rishonim. And many of the Rishonim quote him as being associated with certain social technique, certain social measures, where you create a distance between this husband and the rest of society, and apparently that's acceptable. And Rabbeinu Tam's authority is important in general, because Rabbeinu Tam was Rabbeinu Tam, and Rabbeinu Tam was a great Rishon, but part of why he's so influential here is also because he's known to be a machmir on this issue. So we were discussing over the past few days the question of, can you compel a get for Mois Alai if the wife is repulsed by the husband? The Rambam says yes. But Rabbeinu Tam, in Tosfos and Ksubos, Rabbeinu Tam's position is no, you can't. So the fact that it's the same Rabbeinu Tam who doesn't allow that, but does allow these measures, so that gives an extra level of confidence to the later poskim that this does not cross the threshold into actual kfiyah, and that it's an appropriate technique to use, even if kfiyah is not justified. So, before discussing in any more detail, let me just read to you what the Shulchan Aruch says. So, it's a long sifra chafalif.
What do we call chayr nowadays?
Oh, so no, that's an important point. I'm going to explain that in a second, that no, it's not what we call chayrim. And it's an important distinction. It may seem very similar to chayrim, and I'll discuss in a minute why that's a little bit of a tricky term to use. So just to read what the Shulchan Aruch says here, it's Siman Chafalif, Kufin Dal Chafalif, Kol Eilu Sha'amru Lahotzi, Kofin Afilu Shutin. Right, so this is just to restate a din that we've been talking about, but it's here in the same sif, that if we have a halacha of kofins, then you can hit the guy. You can beat him up in order to get the get. Now in America, you can't. If it's illegal, you can't. But in terms of the halacha by itself, so theoretically, kfiya could justify that. V'yesh omrim, shakol mishol nemar bo betalmud beferish kofin lahotzi, ela yotzi bilvad. Right, here again, very subtle change in language, that if the Gemara doesn't say explicitly kofin lahotzi, just says yotzi, he must do it, but doesn't say kofin, so then ain kofin b'shut. Then you cannot physically compel him. But what should you do? Ela omrim lo chachamim chayvucha lahotzi, that you tell the person that the chachamim have obligated you to divorce your wife. V'yim lo sotzi mutu lekroscha avarin. And if he doesn't do it, then we're allowed to call you an avarian. Right, so you see already the distinctions the Shulchan Aruch is invoking. That there could be a circumstance, a lower threshold, right, where we're not going to allow full-blown kfiyah, but you still convey to the person that there's something wrong with your behavior, and that if you don't change your behavior, it's appropriate to call you an avarian. So that's the Shulchan Aruch. Says the Ramah, V'chev and de'ika plukta de Rav Vasa. Since there is a machlokes among the Rishonim, roi lahachmir shalach of peshutim, shlo yeheged ma'usa. So a circumstance where we don't have a beferish statement in the Gemara that we should be kofa, it's appropriate not to actually beat the guy up because we don't want to have a pasul get. Avalim v'yeshlo isha ba'aveira l'kuli alma kof mishute. If it's a marriage that was prohibited al pidin in the first place, so then still you could. V'chol makom she'en kofim. Now here, this is the important point, and Johnny, listen to this language here, right? V'chol makom she'en kofim b'shutin. If a situation is such that you cannot compel physically, ein menadin oso, that means we don't put him in chair, right? So I'll discuss the source of that in a second. Gamkein, that's also something you don't do. Umikol makom yecholin ligzer al kol Yisrael shlo la'asos lo shum tova olisa v'liten ima. But we can make a policy on all the Jewish people that they shouldn't do him any favors, nor should they interact with him in a business context. Oh, lamol banav, shouldn't give the prasmila to his kids. Oh, lekavra, shouldn't bury his family. Ad shiyagarish. Uvachal chumra shiyirtu bezdi nechom lahachmiran b'ki agavna movad shlo yinadu oso. But any chumra they want, they can impose as long as they don't actually excommunicate him. And if he's not fulfilling his basic marital obligations, he's not, fulfilling the physical obligation he has to her, so then you can impose excommunication on him that he should do one or the other, that either he should actually fulfill his marital responsibilities, or if he's not willing to do that, then he should divorce her. Ki ein ze kfiya rak mekayim onoso, that the kfiya is not in the get, the kfiya is that he should be mekayim his responsibility. B'chein kol kiyotzi b'lo. And so too by everything else related to this. Okay, then there's another bit here which is a little bit less related to this, so we'll skip that. Okay. So that again, kufnan dalet chaf aleph in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. So very important. So here the Ramah is invoking this concept known as Harchokos Terebeinu Tam, which is brought in a number of the Rishonim, including the Sefer HaYashar of Terebeinu Tam. So what do we see here? We see that apparently there's a level called Kfiyah, and this is not it. And that Cherem is apparently included in over the threshold. Cherem is included in Kfiyah itself. Now, why is that? So the Rishonim quote a Gemara in Psachim and a few other places where the Gemara makes it sound like Cherem is worse than Malchus. So if we're going to correlate Malchus to Kfiyah, and Malchus basically is hitting the guy, so we said Kfiyah B'shutim is essentially an act of Malchus, so you could say, essentially, mathematically, that if Cherem is considered by the Gemara as worse than Malchus, so if we don't have license to hit the guy, then we don't have license for Cherem either. So is it just a mathematical point, just a Kal v'chomer? Okay, so the Gemara tells you that one is more imposing than the other, and therefore if you can't do one, you can't do the other, or is there more to it? That's something we have to figure out a little bit. But Cherem in general, so it forces you to think a little bit. So what is so terrible about Cherem? So what is a cherem? Right, a cherem, the way we understand it in practical terms, means that you're not dealing with a person at all. You're going to give them the silent treatment with a capital S, you know, in the real halachic sense. But conceptually, halachically, it has more significance to it. That it's understood to be basically a klala on the person that he should die. So therefore, it carries with it a certain comprehensive nature as far as its severity. And the Gemara in Moed Katan, where the Gemara talks about Avelus, so the Gemara also eventually gets to the Halachas of Cherem. And I believe the Nitziv explains, others explain, that the idea, the connection between Avelus and Cherem is that essentially the person is sitting Shiva for himself. Basically, there was a klal on him that he should die, and we treat him as if that's already happened, that he is observing shiva for himself. So apparently that's already kfiyah. That sounds like it's too much. But we can do something less than that. So what would you say, then, defines where the line is? Right? So if Rebbeinu Tam is telling you what his harchakas are, or later he showed and we're building on them, and saying that these harchakos are okay, but kfi is not okay. So how are you defining the line? Where would you put one thing or the other? Any thoughts? Like, how would you define what's considered to be kfiya and what's not considered to be kfiya? It's an important question, because that's how poskim are going to assess various techniques nowadays, whether or not they cross the line. So no one has any thoughts? Sammy? Okay, so we know that shutin is physical, right? So it seems like that's crossing the line. So maybe should we say that anything that's not physical but is more emotional is not considered to be kfiya? Is that the line? And then cherem is basically the threat of physical, or carries with it the weight of the actual physical death. So that's why it's past the line. So is that the only line? Anything that's not physical you can do?
Are you positive when you're not? When you're not negatively doing anything to him?
Right. Also, some of the Rishonim understand that that's the issue. Right? That basically we can't do anything bad to the guy, but we can withhold positives. So basically what we're saying with the Harchakos, according to this view, which, for example, so I didn't read, when I was reading to you the Shulchan Aruch just now in the Ramah, I didn't read all the citations of the Rishonim that were in the parentheses in between. I skipped over those. But here the Ramah quoted Olam Olbana v'lokavra machiyagari. She has in parentheses Binyamin Zev. So the Tshuvas Binyamin Zev seems to work off this premise. In fact, as later Sfarim point out, that if you look at all the different ways the Rabbeinu Tam is quoted in later sources, you probably have as many as five different nuschos in Rabbeinu Tam, which all emphasize different elements of where the line is. And again, it's an important question, because we need to know practically what we can do and what we can't do. So, essentially, the Binyamin Zev understands like this, that basically it's all about, like Morty said, positive versus negative. That I can't hurt the guy, but I can say that you're not going to get the benefit of the Jewish community. So, for example, if you look at the whole Binyamin Zev inside, so he discusses there that to put the guy in jail, that would be a problem. Right, and to arrange for the government to put him in jail, if there's no other crime that's going on, that would also be probably a double problem, because first of all, that would certainly be a negative action, and it would also be invoking the secular authorities, which opens up a whole other concern. Kfi al yedei akum is also its own complication. But let's say he's in jail for something else. Let's say the United States government puts him in jail for something else. And under other circumstances, the Jewish community would all rally to his defense, and they would come and write letters, they'd come and testify what a great guy he is. But because of what he's doing to his wife, so they're not going to come and do anything. They'll let him sit in jail. So how does that play out? Is that kfiya then? So Yamin Zev says, he quotes this as an example, he says, that's not kfiya, that's like our chokas Rebbeinu Tam, that basically you want the benefit of the Jewish community, so you're not going to get it, then we'll sit this one out, we're not going to help you, even in some pretty extreme cases, that's going to all be okay within the harchakos Rebbeinu Tam category. So that might be the line, maybe that's the line, maybe as Sammy says, maybe it's about actual physical involvement. When he talks about Sammy's point about it being, let's say, actual physical violence, so you could say that that's basically just what kfiya is, that we actually physically force you, so it's got to be something that's such a overwhelming pressure that you're essentially physically compelled to do something. Or we could also focus on the fact, let's say from a halachic perspective, that this is the kind of behavior that's normally not permitted. You can't hit somebody without permission, you know, without a license to do so. It's an avera. So clearly we need some kind of a mandate to do so that's not always there. So then kfiya might give us such permission, and a lack of kfiya means we don't have such permission. So maybe you're drawing a line like that and saying activities that are essentially averas against the other person. So that you can't do, because you're basically saying you can suspend the Torah because of the mandate of kfiya, and if the kfiya is not theirs, so then you can't do it. Or we could define it like Morty was saying, that it's about positives versus negatives, And then we'll again have to figure out where one falls and the other comes up. There is another distinction which is very important, which is quoted by the Maharik. The Maharik is also here in the Ramah, is also in the parentheses, referred to the Maharik. So if you look in the Maharik inside, or you look in the Vilna Gaon, commenting on this Sefer Shemarach, so he throws in another idea, that the individual is not considered to be compelled because he can always go somewhere else. That essentially, if he doesn't like the way he's being treated here in Washington Heights, so he can get up and find somewhere else to go. Right?
Can I assume that goal expands now?
So let's discuss that. So it expands how? So it's an interesting question. I can just tell you practically, again, from dealing with the situations. So let's say in the Facebook era, right? So how has this changed? Is that what you're referring to, Phil? Right? So how does the global village of the internet or any other types of mass communications, so how does that affect things? So you might say, listen, that makes things more effective because you can get the message out to the whole world, but it risks crossing this line because if the whole chap, this is not called kfiyah because you could just leave and go somewhere else, well, now I can't because we've got a million Facebook friends in the whole world and we'll just send the message out to everywhere and he won't be able to go anywhere. So I will tell you that that's not true because as much as you can get the message out to the whole world, it's also the case that maybe also because of the internet or even without it, but there will always be somewhere where there'll be a chevra for such a person. And some community may not be the most respectable community, but I can just tell you practically that there are situations like this going on right now where people who are reviled and the target of much disdain by huge proportions of the world have still found shuls and have still found communities where people are willing to say the whole rest of the world is crazy and you're a persecuted innocent victim and they have somewhere to go. So you might say, okay, that's bad, but it's maybe good because it means that it's you're not going to risk invalidating the get this way because if this is the issue, so then there's always somewhere to go. Now, some of the poskim interpret those two factors together. Right? That maybe, because also it's important to see that some of the Rishonim, when they quote Rabbeinu Tam, so some throw in this idea, some throw in other ideas, so we don't know exactly what is the key defining point. We could also just define it as a matter of degree. We could say that kfiya means you have overwhelming pressure, then essentially it's like, kfiya is basically like what we call Gezel, and as opposed to Gneva. It's actually an important distinction. Because, so Gneva means you got robbed, you didn't see what was happening. Right, Gezel, you got robbed in broad daylight. Right, so, why'd you get robbed in broad daylight? Because somebody was able to say your money or your life. Somebody was able to, as expression goes, give you an offer you can't refuse. That when you're posed, you know, theoretically, the person who gets robbed at gunpoint gave his money over willingly, right? So why don't we say that? Why do we say, no, that's called gezel? Because essentially the choice that he's confronted with is a choice that he doesn't really have free will. Right? The choice that he, yes, he could say no, but then if he's going to get shot, so that's not really a real choice. So at what point does that become the definition? At what point do we say that when you're confronted with two choices, then you really no longer have the actual free will to take the other option? Right? And that presumably is a very relevant question to ask here also. So then it could all be a matter of degree. Right? It could all be that if it's just so overwhelmingly unpleasant for you that you just can't live this way, so then and you have you feel like you no longer have a choice, so then maybe that's kfiya, and if there's other options, you know, you could live this way. It's not great. You'd rather this negative power wasn't coming in, this negative energy wasn't coming at you, but you'll live with it. Maybe that's the issue. Right, which also in some of the Nuschos, Rebbe Thomas, sounds like that's what he's saying. There's a language, think the Ramah didn't quote it here, but in some of the Rishonim, some of the Rabbeinu Tam citations, if something like that, that if Yirtzi Yekaved, if he wants, he'll give the get. If not, he won't. You know, basically, that there's a threshold of okay, he can still live. He'll choose to keep on going despite this discomfort. So then, that's not called kfir. Okay, was there a hand up before? Yeah, got it.
It's different for every person.
So it might be subjective, right? So then, the fact that it could be subjective makes things even more complicated, right?
What if the average person would say no or yes to this?
Right, that's a part of it, but we also may have to calibrate to figure out what the circumstances are, right? So then that already gives us, let's say, four possibilities that we've seen of where the line is. Is the line basically physical pressure specifically? And maybe we'll say specifically doing things that are otherwise prohibited. Is it positive or negative? Is it whether they can escape and go somewhere else? Or is it just basically a judgment call of when your quantitative level, where life is just too unlivable, and therefore it's basically reached to your money or your life level. Right, it's the famous old Jack Benny joke that he was held up at gunpoint, and he said that the guy said to him, "Your money or your life?" And he said, "Hold on, I'm thinking." So apparently there's a certain level where you could think. I once darshan that he got that from his namesake, because Chazal tell us that Yaakov was Chazer al Pachim Ketanim. So then the Gemara says that Mikan Shesadikim Chavivim Aleihem Mamonim Yosar Min Afshasehim. So that you see that the Tzadikim, from Yaakov's behavior, that they are even more makbid on their money than their lives. So Jack Benny was named after Yaakov Avinu, so he apparently also had such a hanhaga. So the point is, sometimes you may feel you can think about it, and sometimes you can't think about it. All right, it's clear that there's nothing left to think about. You have no free will at that point. So what exactly is the threshold here? So this has very important ramifications. So, for example, there is a discussion in Eretz Yisrael, so there is more latitude given to the Rabbanot to do all kinds of things they can't do here. And sometimes, so therefore, for example, the shailas that we discussed about Moyes Alai become much more relevant there, because if the government can throw someone into jail, which you can't do in America, but in Israel you have a Jewish government that can throw somebody into jail for not giving a get. So then, poskim like Bavaji Yosef, for example, has a tshuvas about this. Other poskim have tshuvas about this also. But then we really have to figure out: is it a situation where we can say kfiya is applicable? And then presumably that's kfiya, even though there are those who argue maybe even that's not kfiya. But presumably that's kfiya. But then maybe that's legitimate. Maybe that's something they can do. So sometimes they throw people in jail, and sometimes they don't throw people in jail. But they can do all kinds of other things. They can play with your bank account, or your driver's license, or your right to do this, your right to do that. So is that basically holding back positives? And then the question is also, sometimes they can take away your passport. So that was something some poskim also were trying to figure out. If they take away your passport, so then maybe we should say that that's considered to be a problem combined with the other things, right? That maybe if we look at some of these svaras together, as some of them understand it, that holding back positives is okay, because even though some of these positives are really necessary for you to function in life, but you can always go somewhere else. So if in Washington Heights they're not going to let you do any positives, so then you'll go to New Jersey. Or if it's this whole area, then you'll go to Las Vegas. But you know, if you can't get the positives anywhere in the world, so then that might actually manifest itself as a negative. We're talking about basic services that you need, right? Which is a fundamental difference between a positive and a negative. But if somebody is doing something negative to you, so then that's inherently negative. Positives just means, okay, I'll get the positives from somewhere else. But if I can't go anywhere else, then positive can turn into a negative. Absence of a positive can turn into a negative. So what happens if the Israeli government suspends all kinds of rights from you and also takes away your passport? So now you can't go anywhere else. So how much of a difference does that make? Hi.
Just practically, the power is in the hands of the government. So they would seemingly judge whether it would be allowed, but then only then do this, right? It's not like the secular courts are...
Generally, yeah, I think that's how it works. I hope that's how it works, that the Rabbanut will figure out whether or not the kfiyah is justified. And then they can get the government to work with them to impose penalties like this, hopefully. But then you'll still have a debate whether or not the Rabbanut position is going to be correct in that. So there's a lot of literature about this, particularly Bavadji Yosef and others have many tshuvas addressing when this is appropriate and when it's not appropriate. So it's interesting also to, I know people ask about this all the time, so the question of, let's say, embarrassing somebody. Right? So where does that fit in? So embarrassing someone, a pashtus, is a negative. But is that okay as far as this is concerned? So whether it's okay in terms of mutal l'chadchila or not, so first of all, some point out that it seems like it's beferish in the Shulchan Aruch and in Rishon that the Shulchan Aruch is based on, that you can, at least to a certain degree, embarrass someone, even when kfiya is not called for. Right? Because what did we see in the Shulchan Aruch? That even if you can't beat the guy up, so mutal l'kroscha avaryin. Right, you can essentially tell the person that he is an avarian. So presumably that's at least a little bit embarrassing. Right, so it seems like embarrassment doesn't necessarily cross the threshold into invalid kfiya. And indeed, the Rishonim seem to understand in the Sefer Get Ma'usa, which I have here, which is it's written by the same Mechaber as the Sefer we talked about last week, Elu Shekof and Lahotzis. There's enough to say about the subject to have two separate Sfarim that talk about two separate components. So he points out here from the Rishonim that a get that is extracted through Bizyonis is not considered to be a get Musa. It's not considered to be invalid. So that's interesting to consider why that is. So, is that connected to the heter to embarrass the person or lack of heter? Well, you know, normally it's prohibitive. Moshe Sternbach, for example, has a tshuva where he's generally more machmir about these issues, but he points out that when somebody's in a situation where kfiya is not justified, so but there is still a mitzvah component, he's still mistreating his wife, so then the community takes actions to show that they disapprove of what he's doing, which will mean that they're not going to allow him to be a shliach tzibur, and they're not going to give him an aliyah, and they're not going to give him any kibudim. And he writes there that even though that's a little embarrassing, right, even though there's ksas pizyonis involved in that, but that's understood as a function of the fact that he's acting in a way that society feels is wrong, and therefore society has a right to convey that. And again, the fact that you find the heter to call him an avarian is also reflective of that. So you also have to consider the question, so it could be there's a couple of different madrigas here, that maybe to whatever extent you're embarrassing the person is mutter. Right? Rav Sternbach in that shuva writes that to embarrass the person in a serious way is not mutter, and then he talks about how to evaluate and the kind of judgment calls that are sometimes invoked. So it could be that we can separate the issues, that maybe bizyonis themselves are not going to constitute kfiya, but sometimes they're mutter and sometimes they're not mutter. There's an isser in general, halbanos b'nechad v'rabim, so we have to figure out what is the threshold. Let's say I violated that isser, so it's a terrible thing. The Gemara says, emo chelo go maba, but does that mean that if you violated the isser that constitutes kfiya, are they habaha? So not necessarily. It could be that there's different parameters. So, for example, the whole harchakas to Rebbeinu Tam, it's important to understand. So, many of the poskim, I recently discussed this with Rabbi Willig, who reiterated this position, understand that harchakas to Rebbeinu Tam are not considered to be kfir. Right, so that's the whole nature of their utilization. There were some who thought maybe it's considered to be a type of kfir that is legitimate under more circumstances than hitting people is. But the mashmos of the Rishonim, and the way many poskim understand it, it's simply not kfiya at all. So therefore, the impact of that decision is that, let's say the Beis Din makes a mistake. Right? Let's say the Beis Din says that we're going to tell you to utilize rachakas to Rebbeinu Tam, and they were wrong. The circumstances don't really warrant it. And it's a whole discussion what circumstances warrant it. Some say that it specifically sounds like the Shulchan Aruch is here is bringing it in the context of a situation where we say Yotzi but not Kofin Lahotzi. So is there any threshold at all? Is there any minimum that's necessary for a chakas to rebbein tam? Or does the bezin just decide, okay, this is a disgrace, therefore a chakas to rebbein tam. We feel bad for the wife, so a chakas to rebbein tam. So does it have to be that it's a situation of mitzvah lagarish, of yotzi? Some invoke ma'is alai. Some of the Rishonim say that you need ma'is alai to justify hachakas to rebbein tam. And that it's a function we mentioned yesterday of the takanas agaonim, of the later Rabbanim compared to the Gemara, who decided that we have to take measures in circumstances of ma'is alai. And that maybe it's a kind of quasi-kfiya that's justified under those circumstances. So we have to figure out what circumstances justify hachakas to rebbein tam. So some will maintain it's not kfiya at all. And therefore, if it's not kfiya at all, so we try to get it right. We don't want to mistreat somebody. But the consequences of getting it wrong are not the same as the consequences of misapplying kfiya. If you use kfiya when it's not justified, you're going to have a get batal, you're going to have a get musa, it's going to be no good. You're going to have an eshes ish and mamzerus. If you use harchakas to rebbein tam, and it's not justified, so that's an averia. You have to do tshuva, you have to ask mechila, you have to deal with it. But presumably it doesn't create a get musa. And it seems that's probably also true that if the bizyonos were not justified, so then it's probably also the case that you'll have to do tshuva. Again, the Gemara says, Ma'apnech Ve'Abraham is a terrible Aveira. It's very, very consequential. But it doesn't necessarily invalidate the get, so therefore, from that perspective, the stakes will be lower. Now, it's interesting to consider the question for a second of Habanis Pnech Ve'Abraham, that if we want to use the math, like we did before, in terms of Nidui, in terms of Chayrim, and we said that Chayrim is worse than Malkus. Malkus is Kfiyah, so Chayrim is Kfiyah. So then wait a minute. So if embarrassing someone is like killing them, it sounds like from the Gemara and Bava Metzia. So to kill someone, for sure would be Kfiyah. To threaten to kill him, for sure. If you actually kill him, then she's an Almana. But if you threaten to kill him, so then for sure it's Kfiyah. So why don't we say that threatening to embarrass someone should also be Kfiyah? So I think there's two approaches. One is, again, that maybe the bizyonos are mutter, because if the person is actively involved in oppressing somebody else, so then the bizyonos could be permitted and therefore not subject to the isser in the first place. Or even to the extent that they're usser. So I think we have to also establish that when the Gemara says that halbanos pnei chaver barabim eim ochelak lomva, and it's like shvichas damim, that it doesn't mean that every act of halbanos pnei chaver barabim is automatically equated to shvichas damim. The Gemara is saying that there is a level which is so severe that somebody might theoretically choose to die rather than to endure. As we know, Rahman al-Islam has happened in real life. So I don't think the Gemara is saying that in every case it is actually equal to Shvichas Damim. The whole discussion of posting, we won't go into it now because it's long. We had an opportunity to talk about it a little bit in this month in a different context. But one could say that, yes, there are cases where posting have actually equated, based on the Gemara and Bava Metzia, have actually equated Halbanos Pnei Chaver Barabim to Shvichas Damim. But it doesn't mean every embarrassment is like Shvichas Damim. So if it's not the kind of embarrassment that the individual would rather die to avoid, so then it doesn't necessarily reach that threshold, and we don't necessarily have this Kal Vachomer. So it goes back to that same Nusach of Rebbeinu Tam, that if a person's willing to endure this, he'd much rather it's not happening. But it still leaves him with the option, okay, I wish people were not embarrassing me, but I could still live with being embarrassed, and I'm not going to go ahead and do this. So then, that shows that it's not kfiyah. So that also requires us to try to figure out, when we say that chayrim is off limits, so then, what exactly is the issue with chayrim? Is it the mathematical point? Is it that it just all we have is a Gemara, basically math, that the Gemara tells us that Chayrim is worse than Malkus, so Malkus is Kfiyah, so Chayrim is Kfiyah? Or is it something conceptual? So if it's that Chayrim is like a Klolot Adai, so then fine, so then maybe that's the issue. But what, and therefore these hachakas or ben atam will say they don't add up to any such klala. They just functionally mean we're not going to deal with it. But what if it's not like that? What if we say that it's the impact of a cherem? It means that people need social interaction. Right? The Gemara also says in Tainis, O Chavrusa, O Misusa, that if you have no degree of social interaction, so that's also like death. So, is that the issue? That maybe cherem represents a certain degree of complete social isolation? And the Harchakas of Rebbeinu Tam were meant to be formulated in a way that they don't necessarily reach that level. But what if the social context is such that they do reach that level? So you find like that in some Achronim. Some Achronim say that they think that Harchakas of Rebbeinu Tam is like Nidui, and therefore shouldn't be employed, either unless circumstances very clearly call for them. Or some say it shouldn't be used at all nowadays because they also constitute a type of cherem bisman hazeh. So the Gvuras Hanashim, for example, we mentioned the other day, the Shach wrote a sefer called the Gvuras Hanashim. So in general, he was very machmir on all these issues in ways that have not necessarily been accepted by the later poskim. But he says that in his day already that the Hachakas Rebbeinu Tam are like Nidui. So that goes to the question of what exactly Nidui is. And why is it something that is past the threshold? So all of this now maybe is a good point for a transition. So maybe we'll set up the issue that we'll continue with, God willing, on Monday, I guess is our next shiur. The question of where does money fit into this? Right, so what about onus mamos? This is also a good segue for those who are in the shir this year to connect the first zman of the past year and the second zman. So if you recall, there is a gemara in the second parak of Ksubas where the gemara talks about Aden who sign on a shtar and say afterwards that they didn't really sign of their own free will, that they were forced to sign. So the Gemara there says, well, what are we talking about when we say they were forced to sign? So they mean anusim anachnu, anusim hayinu machmas nefashos, that somebody put a gun to our head and said, we'll kill you unless you sign, so that's why we signed the shtar falsely? Or was it the less legitimate excuse of anusim hayinu machmas mamon, that there was monetary pressure that was exerted upon us, and that's how we felt compelled to falsely sign a shtar? So what exactly does that mean? So that Gemara is already alluding to the concept that there is such a concept of anusim machmas mamon, which in that case is not enough of an excuse. It's differentiated from machmas nefashos. So it seems from there and from other sources that, many other sources that are actually more explicit about this, that there is such a concept of ones al yidei mamon. So if somebody is going to threaten you, threaten, by the way, is also an interesting question, just in the parenthetically, all the things that we're talking about, if they do or do not qualify, so what if you're not allowed to do something, are you allowed to threaten it? So does threaten also therefore equal a negative act? Or do we say threatening by its very nature, like some people sometimes use the word by itself as itself, an act of negativity is therefore a negative action? Or do we say that threatening is less than the actual action? Gemara has an expression, avid imish de gazim below avid. Sometimes a person speaks in a more extreme way and doesn't actually carry it out. So does that mean that that's okay, that you can threaten somebody and you can then always claim, well, they should know I wasn't really going to do it, I'm just talking that way, and therefore it's not a musa problem? So that's also a question, whether you can threaten something and then not actually have to follow through with it. But what about the threat of monetary consequences? So this is a very, very big issue, because, just to sketch the outline, we'll pick up with this next week, so most of the Rishonim seem to assume that onus al yidei mamon is considered to be an onus, right? That to threaten somebody with monetary loss is considered to be compulsion. So we have to figure out the parameters of that. First of all, there are different degrees of monetary loss. And also, how does that correlate to, let's say, monetary benefit? What about a husband, as we know happens very often nowadays, a husband says he'll do it for money. Right, so how does that factor in? So what about using monetary inducements? Is that the same thing as monetary pressure? Presumably not. That's what we'll have to figure out. So what is the issue with monetary pressure? What type of monetary pressure is a problem? What type isn't a problem? And it's going to have major effects because we're going to talk about, God willing, the prenups, which, as you know, we strongly encourage the prenups, but the question is we have to explain why the prenups, which involve a monetary consequence, using that word very powerfully, advisedly, right, there's a monetary consequence associated with the prenups that we generally talk about. So how does that fit into this discussion? And maybe in a very different way, I don't know if you're familiar with the controversy, God willing, we'll talk about the New York State get law. So this is a major issue, so God willing, we'll get to it next week. But New York State has two get laws, one from the 80s and one from the 90s. And there's been much, much discussion, very, very highly controversial, because, I'll explain how, it involves triggering a monetary consequence for refusal to give the get. And essentially the New York State courts carrying out a monetary consequence for not giving the get, and that has raised the specter of kfiya al yedei mamon through the secular courts, and that's been the topic of tremendous, tremendous controversy, which we'll have to try to figure out. So our next step basically is to pick up from that question, where exactly does money fit in? So just quickly, Chaza, we spoke about tonight, so we spoke about the question of that even if there's no kfiya, so we have to figure out what is possible, especially in light of the fact that the Shulchan Aruch, apparently different from the Rambam, does recognize different categories, that if there's no kfiya, there could still be mitzvah or chiyuv, and that has its own set of rules. So the idea of the Hachakas Rabbeinu Tam, which many of the Rishonim quote, including the Rama, in the same sif, in the Chaf Aleph, Kuftan Dalet Chaf Aleph and Ebenezer, that even when we're not rising to the level of kfiya, that you can distance yourself from the individual. So we have to figure out where is this line that something is called kfiya and where is it called Hachakas Rabbeinu Tam, which is apparently not kfiya and can be justified in much broader context. So we have various suggestions, whether it has to do with physical, non-physical, whether it has to do with positive versus negative, whether it has to do with a person being able to escape, whether it's just a question of degree, is the pressure so overwhelming that you can no longer exercise free will. All of those, could it be some of them in combination with others? How exactly do we assess those? We talked about the role of bizyonis, that it seems that bizyonis does not invalidate get. We talked about why that might be. How exactly does that factor in into the category of the isser of habanis b'nei chaver b'rabim? What's the question there? And we discussed circumstances where it's possible you might be doing something wrong against this guy, but even if that's the case, it might be an avera that doesn't invalidate the get, but an avera by itself, which is a different kind of stakes. And we talked about what the issue is with cheirim, why does cheirim cross the line, and what is going to be put in that category. And then we set up this question of money, how exactly does money fit in, which is going to have major impact in discussion of prenups, the get law, and other types of strategies. And God willing, we'll pick up with that point on Monday. Wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos. Good things.